Boston Celtics on Thursday night. In the NHL, the Blackhawks lost to the Edmonton Oilers 2-1 last night. They're off tonight. They will skate in Winnipeg on Thursday against the Jets. And just a reminder, coming up in the NFL this weekend, the Packers will meet the Dallas Cowboys in Dallas on Sunday at 3:30 in a wild card game. The winner of that game advances to the divisional round the following weekend. And the other wild card games this weekend are on Saturday, Cleveland and Houston, and Miami and Kansas City. Then on Sunday, along with the Packer game, the Steelers and the Buffalo Bills, the Rams and the Lions, and the Eagles and Tampa Bay. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Today, cloudy and windy, a high of 36, winds 10 to 30 miles per hour. Looking ahead a little bit, tonight, sunset 4:36, a little more snow and freezing rain, maybe an inch or so, a low of 25. Thursday, cloudy and 33. Friday, cloudy, a light rain, snow mix likely, a high of 33. And here's the weekend. Saturday, 60% chance of light snow, a high of 23. And then the cold moves in. Sunday, 30% chance of light snow, a high of 8. Monday's high, 3. Tuesday's high, 6. Looking at the current numbers now from the National Weather Service, the wind is from the northwest at 12, 34 degrees in Racine, 35 in Kenosha, 34 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We've been devoting these morning shows of early 2024 to some of our favorite interviews from last year. And today, two interviews related to the world of professional sports and to some great, pioneering, trailblazing black athletes. We begin with sports writer Yehuda Williams and his book, Call Him Jack, The Story of Jackie Robinson, Black Freedom Fighter. This book does a wonderful job of helping us understand the way in which Jackie Robinson's early life helped shape him into the amazing man he grew up to be. We'll pick up the interview as Yehuda Williams talks about an important circle of friends for young Jackie Robinson, a group known affectionately as the Pepper Street Gang.
Well, it's this colorful cast of characters. I don't know that your younger listeners will appreciate this, but they call themselves the Pepper Street Gang, but they're not a gang in the sense that we would think about gangs today. They're more akin to, again, going back a couple of generations here, our gang or the Bowery Boys. And it's just a group of essentially the outcasts who live in Jack's neighborhood, African-Americans, Latinos, Asians, who also would have suffered from discriminatory action, who band together because they share, this exclusion from the mainstream, and they get into all kinds of mischief, mostly harmless fun, some mischief making that is not so harmless, like the time they dig up, after they are insulted by a neighbor, they dig up this person's yard, and Jack's mom has to intervene and have them go back and replace the sod. But they, just Jack kind of leading this motley but colorful cast of young people in that neighborhood who otherwise would have been misfits and outcasts. The same people that he's swimming with in the reservoir are the same people who would have been denied access to the lunch counters, the same people who couldn't get a library card. And that's really what forms the bond that draws them together. And so the Pepper Gang, again, just a really interesting way or interesting insight into Jack's personality and the fact that he's always leading. And this is the thing that we really appreciated about telling his story, that Jack just, you can see this throughout his life. There's this desire not only to push back for himself, but for others. It always seems to be this kind of running theme for him, even from early on, that when he pushes back, it's not just about him. It's about trying to get those same opportunities for other people.
Mm. So when he was playing all these sports in high school, would he have been playing on an integrated team? And would he be facing integrated teams, I mean, in terms of opponents?
Absolutely. And that's what makes that 1947 moment so important. You know, most people think about Jack stepping on the field and being greeted with a hail of kind of racial insults and slurs. That wasn't new to Jack. There was nothing that people were saying during his debut with the Dodgers or with Montreal that Jack hadn't heard, a million times before at UCLA, at Pasadena Junior College. He had played against white athletes. He had played on integrated teams. So this would not in any way have been foreign to him. And it's one of the things that we emphasize in the book that, it takes a tremendous amount of courage for Jack to do that. And yet at the same time, there's nothing about that that's unique because Jack had faced that same type of animosity many, many times before.
And it's,
and what stands out is that he always performed at the highest level in spite of that.
Right. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why Branch Rickey, not to leap too far ahead, felt like Jackie Robinson was the best choice to be the first in Major League Baseball because of some of this past history. I wonder if you'd tell our listeners the story of what occurred shortly after Jackie Robinson enrolled at Pasadena Junior College. There was quite an eruption of outright hatred amongst his own teammates, and the way in which he dealt with that head on is really quite inspiring and impressive.
He's a very dignified individual, Greg. Thank you for asking that question. It's one of the things that the main reason we really wanted to target this to the audience that we did is we believe that young people in this moment are devoid of heroes who in some sense demonstrate the immortal advice that Mr. Antolini gives Holden Caulfield in J.D. Salinger's book, The Catcher in the Rye, where he tells, a young Holden Caulfield, the mark of an immature man is that he's willing to die for a cause, while the mark of a mature man is that he's willing to live humbly for one. Jack both fought back and at times lived humbly for justice and let his playing do the talking. Left you with the sense that you were dealing with somebody who you couldn't rattle, not only because he was supremely confident in himself, but because he fundamentally believed in his own self-worth. And certainly we can see, the influence of his mother on helping to create that sense of dignity, that sense of purpose that you see that is so palpable in his reaction to other incidents that, quite frankly, would have left other people, if not, angered, shaken, and put them in a position where they may not have been able to rise above that to perform in the way that Jack does. You talked about Pasadena, again, later on when Jack's teammates on the Dodgers take a, basically write to ownership and say, we can't play with this African-American. Jack's ability to weather that is all part of his formation early on in the way that he handled a very dignified way, similar challenges. Doesn't mean, and we emphasize this in the book, that Jack doesn't also get into some scrapes, like fighting, he gets into a pretty nasty brawl at one point after he's insulted at a meet, and he chases down a gentleman one day who hurls a racial slur at him when he's driving. So he can be a hothead, but it's this journey of watching him learn how to channel that energy in ways that are constructive that we thought was such a compelling story for young people, and why we wanted to tell the stories in the book like Pasadena, why we wanted to emphasize those moments in his life, because they definitely, I think, illustrate for young people what it means to be contemplative in action and what it means to live humbly for justice and to recognize that sometimes the better route is to think in terms of how you can win others over by the force of your convictions as opposed to by yourself.
Absolutely. In fact, I think at one point we read in your book the term selective retaliation. As something that Jack Robinson had practiced during his life. I mean, that making the choice, sometimes probably not an easy choice, to not lash out at every single instance of disrespect or worse, but in a sense, picking your battles wisely and standing your ground, you know, in various ways depending on the circumstances and so on. And those were probably hard fought lessons and hard fought wisdom that he ultimately earned.
Indeed.
You tell us at UCLA, interestingly, he really struggled in baseball, in the sport that we think of as the best of all of the many sports he played. Just say a quick word about the nature of the struggles which he had on the baseball diamond at UCLA.
Well, he struggled with his hitting in particular, and I think the interesting thing about Jack is that he was such an incredible athlete. I mean, this was true in all the sports that he played, and it's certainly true when Branch Rickey reaches out, and there's this debate, you know, in the Negro Leagues in particular, you know, was Jack the best Negro League player? The answer to that is probably no. Was Jack the best athlete? Did he bring so many other talents to the table that made him a threat in other ways? Certainly Jack was that. Football was actually, you know, his strongest sport at UCLA, and he is in the paper constantly. He plays, you know, kicker, punter, quarterback. I mean, he is dominant on the gridiron. And most people would have assumed that that would have been Jack's trajectory. But he was a heck of an athlete, and I think that's part of the kind of interesting thing. If not for the, you know, Jack's also an incredible tennis player. One thing that we don't write about in the book, but we certainly used about in the writing of the book, is imagine if that public pool had not been closed to Jack Roosevelt Robinson. We might be even talking about Jack as an Olympic caliber swimmer. He was competitive, and he just had that natural, you know, athletic ability, and he utilized that and maximized that in ways that, you know, certainly made him the best pick as an all-around athlete. He's even struggling a little bit when Clyde Tuchelforth comes out to scout him for Branch Rickey. But again, anyone could look at his kind of his speed, his instincts, his baseball IQ, but his sports IQ. It wasn't just baseball. I mean, across the board, he was just a very thoughtful player. You knew that you were getting an incredible athlete, and I think that that's what he evidenced at UCLA. And all those sports, even though, as you point out, baseball was not his strongest suit at that point.
Certainly one of the most interesting passages in the book is when you talk about his experience in the U.S. Army and some of the work that he did, particularly when he was put in charge of the morale among black soldiers on his base, and some of what he did in terms of fighting against segregated seating in the dining hall and on the bus and so on. And one incident that occurs in which he is ultimately arrested and charged with insubordination, although ultimately acquitted. But I mean, here again, we really are seeing the face of a civil rights warrior. And that is so at odds with what we most often think of in terms of his persona.
I couldn't agree more, and I think this is part of the problem, the invention of Jackie Robinson, as opposed to looking at and really interrogating the life of Jack Robinson. And I think nothing encapsulates that better than what happens on that Texas bus in 1944. Jack is returning home, suffering from an ankle injury, and he's on this bus, and he sits down next to a friend of his, a light-complected woman of color, who the driver assumes is a white woman. And the driver immediately demands that Lieutenant Robinson immediately remove himself to the back of the bus for violating, the spoken and unspoken code of, you know, blacks at the back of the bus and no undue familiarity with white women in particular. Jack, of course, had read that there was to be no segregation on army posts. During the Second World War, of course, the United States was at war with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, both of which are pushing racial regimes. I think in the case of everyone familiar with the Nazis more so, this notion of white supremacy and master race. And when the United States tries to challenge that diplomatically, the answer comes back resoundingly from Germany and from Japan, the nerve of you to talk about us. Look at the system of segregation in the United States. And so the U.S. Army has to combat that. They can't do that by wiping out segregation in every southern hamlet and village. They can do it by saying there should be no segregation on U.S. Army bases, and Jack is familiar with that. So he refuses to give up his seat. The driver is infuriated by this. So a woman on the bus demands that the police be called, and the driver uses a racial slur against Jack. When the police come, they ask Lieutenant Robinson why he didn't remove himself, and at that point they claim that Jack had used a curse word. And so he is arrested and goes through court-martial proceedings. Now, I want to be very clear, Greg. If this does not go in Jack's favor, he's not integrating the Dodgers with French Rickey 3 years later, 1947, because he would have been branded a criminal. It would have been very easy for his detractors to point to this incident as an example of him not being worthy. You know, this would have been evidence of the so-called criminal nature of black people and why they didn't deserve the opportunity to play in sports. But when Jack goes before that court-martial review board, he's able to point to not only those orders that came out from Washington with regard to no segregation on Army bases, but when he's asked squarely by the tribunal why he challenges being called, and it was the N-word, unfortunately, why he even called that, Jack says, because my grandmother taught me that that word refers to a low and uncouth person. I don't consider myself uncouth. I don't consider myself low. I don't consider myself an N-word. Really powerful testimony. And Jack is able to, the tribunal ultimately finds in Jack's favor, and there is no court-martial. He musters out in the Army with a honorable discharge. But that is one of those moments where, again, Jack is fighting for himself, but by extension, fighting back for others and demanding. If we're going to fight for the United States, we demand the same dignity and respect afforded to other Americans who are willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. And he demonstrates that on that Texas bus and in the proceedings against him in the court-martial.
It's an incredible story, and again, one largely unknown to most of us. Ultimately, your book, of course, takes us into the professional baseball career of Jackie Robinson, first with the Negro Leagues and then into the major leagues. And of course, most of us know at least something of that story of Branch Rickey and so on, and we learn more from your book. I want to have you tell our listeners about a dramatic and meaningful moment that occurs when he's still a minor leaguer with the Montreal Royals. And actually, I think this occurred in his very first game with the Royals, in which he hits a very dramatic home run. Your book tells the amazing story of who greeted him as he came into home plate, his first minor league home run, a dramatic moment and some courage shown by one of his teammates, George Shuba.
Yeah, it's a great story. It's in Jersey City, of all places, and it's a little bit of a holiday. Everybody's eyes are on Jack. And the question is, how will he, perform in this game? Of course, he's nervous. Rachel's nervous. And African-Americans come from, far and wide to see this game. In fact, the mayor of Jersey City closed the school. It's a little bit of a holiday. They've done that every year, but it takes on an even more important tone because this is going to be Jack's minor league debut with Montreal. But he hits this home run, and, in the hitting of this home run, of course, African-Americans in the field are up. I mean, they know that Jack is capable. But there was always this question, would Jack be accepted by white fans? People knew that there was going to be pushback, that there would be animosity. But the question is, could they get behind somebody who was performing and could they celebrate his success? But more intimately, the question is, could his teammates do that? Could his coaches do that? And when Shuba walks out to greet him and extends his hand, I think that answered that question in a very dramatic way. Everybody focuses on the kind of apocryphal story of whether Pee Wee Reese actually put his arm around Jack, and Ken Burns has debunked that to a large extent. But this Shuba moment is real, and it is powerful because, here's Shuba in some sense saying, as long as you're performing, you're one of us. And we're with you. It was a really powerful moment.
And you have a photograph of it in the book, that moment when George Shuba is extending his hand to to his teammate. I so appreciated learning about that moment. And, of course, your book goes on to chronicle Jackie Robinson's career with the Brooklyn Dodgers, the amazing things that he does, despite the sort of dual identity of being Jack Robinson and Jackie Robinson, the gentle, non-threatening, dignified gentleman, trying to wear both of those hats, both of those personas simultaneously. Your book explores that to such an interesting, meaningful extent. And, of course, beyond that, then the civil rights work that Jackie Robinson does after his Major League Baseball playing days are over. Ultimately, I suspect that the closer you looked at this man and his life, the more you came to admire him.
I think that's true. I fell in love. It's interesting because Michael and I talk about this a lot. The moment at which you, as a biographer, historian, simply as a fan, you come to appreciate athletes in a very abstract place in terms of what they do on the field. And we're often disappointed when we're exposed to them in other arenas. In some sense, kind of lose, predictably, the awe that goes along with watching somebody hit a home run when down three or score the winning touchdown or shoot the winning basket. There's none of that with Jack. You're almost as awestruck with him off the field. In fact, more so. And you walk away from, hopefully readers will walk away from reading this book saying, he's a complex human being. And there's beauty in complexity. And we need to get back to celebrating the beauty in complexity. Jack wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but he was the best human he could be.
Yehuda Williams' book is Call Him Jack, The Story of Jackie Robinson, Black Freedom Fighter. And you can hear this interview in its entirety in the podcast version of The Morning Show. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD. And for part two, we're going to be hearing my conversation with ESPN's Jason Reed, talking about his fascinating book, Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. He charts the story of the emergence of black quarterbacks in both collegiate and professional football.
This is the first book I've ever written. And, you know, from speaking to friends of mine who have written books, like the first one, and a chance to do more of them, they have to be things that you're passionate about, and they have to be things that you really want to spend a lot of hours on, you know, trying to make as full as you possibly can. And I've always been interested in history, and you know, back in 2019, I went to my editors at ESPN, and I told them that I wanted to examine black quarterbacks that season, because that was actually the 100th season of the NFL. The NFL was commemorating its 100th anniversary in that season. And it just seemed to me, from talking to people, that black quarterbacks who had been historically among the most marginalized players in the NFL had risen to a point at that point where it was no longer, you know, an oddity to see a black quarterback. You talk about your experience growing up, you know, as a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and Jefferson Street, Joe Gilliam. It was such a strange thing, really, for lack of a better way to put it, to see a black man playing quarterback in the NFL in the 1970s. But by 2019, things had gotten to a point where black quarterbacks were on the verge of having the greatest seasons they had ever had. And the juxtaposition of the 100th season of the NFL, I just thought there was something there. Well, as it turned out, Lamar Jackson of the Baltimore Ravens won the NFL MVP award. He was only the second unanimous winner of that award as a quarterback. He joined Tom Brady in that category, the legendary quarterback who is now at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. You had Patrick Mahomes lead the Kansas City Chiefs to the Super Bowl, and he won the Super Bowl MVP award. You had Russell Wilson have another great season with Seattle. He probably, if the award had not been won unanimously by Lamar Jackson, Russell Wilson would have been second in that voting. You had Kyler Murray, who was the number one overall draft pick coming into that season, who won the AP Rookie of the Year award. And then Dak Prescott with the Dallas Cowboys had a great season. So as it turned out, black quarterbacks did have an unprecedented season. And after the season, it's funny, I was actually in my Uber going to the airport after the Chiefs had defeated the San Francisco 49ers in Miami at the Super Bowl, and I'm in my Uber going back, and I got a couple of calls from book agents who told me they'd been following my season-long series, and they thought there was a book here. Well, as it turned out, there was a book here.
That's for sure. I mean, it's an amazing book, and you explore so much here, and I so deeply appreciate the care with which you've told this important story. And, of course, you're absolutely right. We're getting to a point now where it almost seems ludicrous to even talk about a black quarterback in the NFL, as ludicrous as we would say, oh, he's a black wide receiver. I mean, it's to the point now where there are so many luminaries, and they are becoming a dominant presence, and also, in a sense, kind of a normal presence in the NFL in a way that would have been unthinkable a half a century ago. One of my questions is, why do we, generally speaking, know so little about the start of this, compared to, for instance, the way in which just about all of us know who Jackie Robinson was? How is it that the start of this particular story is so obscure for just about all of us?
Well, you know, that's a great point, that it is really obscure, that you know, many of these people have been lost to history. And I think part of the reason why is that when we look at the emergence of the NFL as the dominant sports league in America, and really the most powerful and successful sports league in the history of professional sports, it was a journey that was many decades in the making. And by the, you know, we know so much about Jackie Robinson because, remember, back in the 1940s and the 50s and even, you know, into the 60s, Major League Baseball was the dominant sport in America. So when you look at the NFL really wasn't, it didn't have as many eyeballs on it. So, you know, we can go back to the start of the NFL back in 1920, and, you know, we have Fritz Pollard, who's the first black star player in the NFL, and he actually winds up being the first black coach, and he's also the first black quarterback. Now, quarterback looked much different back then, but he did line up at quarterback. And then we have to go really all the way to 1968 to see Marlon Briscoe, who's the first black quarterback of the modern era. So really there was so much time there, and including in this time is a 12-year ban where African Americans were not allowed to play in the NFL, that the country wasn't focused on that league in the way that it was hyper-focused on Major League Baseball. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we don't know, or at least I hope we know now after people read this book, that many people aren't aware of the stories of the players who came before the Patrick Mahomeses and the Lamar Jacksons of the world.
And you are serving all of us so well by telling us these important stories. For any of you joining us, I'm speaking with Jason Reed, author of the brand new book, Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. You touched on the name of Marlon Briscoe, and his story is particularly interesting. And of course, also a story which we read with frustration, if not outright rage, in terms of the way in which he was treated by the Denver Broncos and their head coach at the time. First of all, describe the high quality of his rookie season with the Denver Broncos and the circumstances under which he even started as their quarterback.
Yeah, Marlon's story is really one of my favorite chapters in the book, but also probably the saddest chapter in the book. Marlon Briscoe was a star quarterback at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Not a big school, and he didn't fit the prototypical size of a quarterback. Marlon was 5'9", 5'10", maybe 175 pounds, dripping wet. And, you know, back in 1968, when Marlon was entering the NFL, well, at the time, the AFL draft, the old AFL before the AFL and the NFL merged, black men were not being drafted to play quarterback in either of the two major professional football leagues in the country at that point. If a black quarterback in college was good enough or considered good enough by the NFL and AFL to make it to the pros, that player understood he would just have to change positions. black quarterbacks were changed to be wide receivers. They were changed to be cornerbacks predominantly. Other positions as well, you know, some would be running backs, some would be safeties. But the reality of it is you knew you had to change positions. Well, the Broncos drafted Mullen in the 14th round of the AFL draft. You know, he's a low-round draft pick, but they thought he had potential at cornerback. Well, Marlon throws him a curveball. He says, I won't sign as a cornerback unless you give me a trial at quarterback. And the team thought he was being ridiculous, but they, you know, they played along. The process was completely rigged, of course. I mean, he never had a chance to actually, no matter how well he performed, actually be the team's quarterback. But he did, by all accounts from researching the book, perform well. And, you know, Marlon told me when we sat down for an interview, like, no, I did very well. But he knew that he wouldn't get the job. So anyway, what happened was the starter of the team at quarterback winds up getting hurt. Other players are ineffective. The team gets off to a bad start. So they throw Marlon in there because, you know, they don't think, okay, there's nobody better and, you know, they're not having a good season anyway. Well, you know, shockingly to the people around the team, Marlon played very well. And he sets a Denver Broncos rookie record, which still stands today, for touchdown passes. He finishes high in the AFL Rookie of the Year voting. And he goes home to Omaha to work on his degree and gets a phone call from someone in Denver who tells him that, hey, just to let you know, they're having quarterback meetings out here. And Marlon's like, well, that's impossible. I'm the quarterback. They couldn't do that. Comes to find out that the team took the job away from him. No reason was given. Marlon told me that later he had heard that management was concerned about how white fans would react to him being the quarterback moving forward. You know, that it was one thing when they were having a bad season and throw him in there as emergency. It was quite another to start a season with him there. So the team winds up releasing him. Marlon reinvents himself as a wide receiver, and he has a very good career moving forward as a wide receiver with the Buffalo Bills, goes to the Miami Dolphins, gets traded there, wins a couple of Super Bowls, was on the Miami Dolphins undefeated team with Don Shula as the head coach. And you know, he goes on to after retirement from the NFL, Marlon was always good with numbers, and he winds up making a good living in the financial industry. But his story takes a turn because he gets hooked on drugs, and he winds up going to jail. And you know, Marlon told me that he will never blame his drug addiction specifically on what happened to him, that this job that he loved, that he proved he could do, was taken away from him. But that was that did create a hole in him. And it was taken from him from no other reason than racism. And when we talk about, like, pioneers, like, we have to talk about Marlon Briscoe, who many people have never heard that name. But Marlon Briscoe really was the first one to get the door open, and sadly it was taken away from him.
Hmm. And, of course, your book is not only about stories that are laced with those kind of indignities, but ultimately your book tells stories of greater success achieved by the likes of course, Warren Moon and Michael Vick and Doug Williams and many, many others, to say nothing of the spectacular young black quarterbacks who are such an integral part of the NFL today. One of the things your book does, of course, is helps us understand what that attitude was all about. That is, that attitude that shut out blacks from the position of quarterback at a time when they were welcome to play other positions. And you make a very persuasive case for this really coming down to a gross misunderstanding of the leadership qualities of the typical black man. Tell us more about what the fears were of, for instance, coaches and owners in terms of if a black man was given the reins of a quarterback, of a team as their quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems crazy now what I'm about to say, but the prevailing belief among the people who held the marionette strings in the NFL for most of NFL history was that black men were just inherently inferior to white men and lacked the intelligence, the leadership capability, the toughness, the courage to succeed at the most important position in all of team sports, and they and even more importantly, simply could not lead white men. And the quarterback is the leadership position. It's the position that everything flows from. And so you had team owners and club executives and head coaches all thinking that if you put a black man at quarterback, your team would fail, that there was no other way around this, that blacks simply could not handle the rigors of the position, the things that you had to do on a day in day out basis to succeed. And I've been doing a lot of interviews around the book, obviously, and some people have said to me, well, you know, that just seems like such a crazy notion. But we've got to remember that for most of American history, there's been a belief among, you know, many white people that black people, you know, we can go from slavery to Jim Crow to the emergence of the civil rights movement, in a very large scale in the 1960s, and many white people felt that black people were inferior. And so it stands to reason that the white owners of the NFL, the white coaches, because there were no black coaches, there were no black owners. So it stands to reason that this would be the kind of mood of the day. And it's when you look at these superstar black quarterbacks right now, it's really difficult for people who don't know the history of it to even understand, well, you know, that doesn't make any sense. Well, you know, how could you even say that? But this was, in fact, the case.
One of the questions that came to my mind as I was reading about that and thinking about that terrible assumption, of course, that coaches and owners alike were making about black men and their capabilities, it made me wonder, in a terrible sort of way, did they have a point in the sense that what about white players on a given team and their willingness to follow a black man as quarterback? At the time that this was becoming a viable possibility, what is your sense of the presence on the roster of NFL teams of racist white players who would have been offended at the notion of being led by a black quarterback? Or do you think there was not much of that, and was this just a sadly outmoded, gross misunderstanding on the part of coaches and owners?
You know, you're the first person who's asked me that, and I'm glad you did. I think, you know, from all the interviews, and let me go take this back to Marlon Briscoe. You know, I asked Marlon, well, did you feel that your teammates, and, you know, many of his teammates were white, did you feel that your teammates did not, you know, respect you, did not? And he's like, no. I mean, that was the great thing about it, that obviously ownership had that fear, the coaches had that fear, but he told me that, like, when he finally got in it, because he didn't start the season in that job, it wasn't until there were events where the starter got hurt and other people weren't affected. He got in there, but he didn't start the opening game there. But he told me that the sense he got, and, you know, look, let me preface this by saying no one knows what people say, you know, behind our backs.
Right.
But he told me that the sense he got of it was that, at least in the huddle and at least, you know, in a public display, that his white teammates did support him. He never felt that the offensive line didn't block for him. He never felt that, you know, white players at running back or receiver didn't catch for him. He felt like he was respected. Now, having said that, as we look at just the overall feeling about this, I'm sure that if there had been multiple black quarterbacks starting it, yeah, I would not be surprised if several of those quarterbacks' teammates would have had problems with that. Because, look, if we just look at the odds, if you have people in America in the 1960s, and when I say people, I'm talking about white people. If you have white people in the 1960s who have these views that black people are inherently inferior, and I would submit that those views were much more accepted during that time. Well, just the odds say that there would be football players who hold those same views. But, you know, we can't test the theory because Marlon was the only one.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting what if, isn't it? Well, at any rate, your book, of course, tells us the story of, for instance, Warren Moon, the great quarterback of both the Oilers and the Seahawks, who I think, if I understand correctly, coming out of his distinguished career at the University of Washington, did not necessarily feel like he was going to be welcomed in the NFL as a quarterback, which is why he took his great talents to the CFL and only eventually back to the NFL. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the thing that's just so insidious about that situation is that Warren Moon was the co-player of the year of his conference as a senior. He helped the University of Washington win the Rose Bowl, a very prestigious Rose Bowl game, and he winds up not getting drafted. I mean, because the year he came out in 1978, the year he came out of college, black men still, on a large scale, were not being, well, not even a large scale, black men basically were not being drafted to play quarterback in the NFL. So he had to go to Canada if he wanted to continue his career as a quarterback. He goes to Canada, he thrives. He becomes a record-setting passer in Canada. He wins championships. Eventually, the NFL can't deny that this guy is, you know, pretty good. And he signs as a free agent with the Houston Oilers. He struggled his first year, but after that transition period, he takes off. He becomes a perennial Pro Bowl player. He finishes high in the NFL MVP voting. He has a great career, and he actually winds up being the only black quarterback enshrined in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But, you know, the thing that's just so sad about that situation is if the people who were running the NFL had been more open-minded, Warren Moon, all those years he was up in Canada, if he had been playing in the NFL all those years, he might own every single passing record there is right now. But because he started in the Canadian Football League and had to spend so many years there, by the time he got to the NFL, you know, he was later in his career. He still had a great career in the NFL, which shows how talented he actually was. But what could have been, you know? We talk about the what-ifs and the what could have been, and I think Warren Moon is a perfect example of that.
Very much so. Among the array of stunningly talented black quarterbacks in the NFL today, of course, we have Patrick Mahomes and Russell Wilson and Dak Prescott and Lamar Jackson and Kyler Murray and, of course, the Deshaun Watson, who is making headlines for exactly the wrong reasons with his recent NFL six-game suspension. But by and large, when you look at this current crop of NFL luminaries, beyond their talent and ability and skills, how would you assess them in terms of being, first of all, the face of their teams, as quarterbacks are often thought? And that, of course, was also sometimes at the heart of the reluctance of some owners and coaches to have blacks as their quarterbacks. But how would you assess the way in which they are fulfilling those kind of roles with their teams in terms of being the face of that team and leaders that can be looked up to in more ways than one?
Yeah, you know, it's you're absolutely right that a big part of why these owners, team owners, historically did not want black men to occupy that position is because the quarterback is the face of the team. And, you know, when you're trying to market to your fans, white fans, as we discussed, these owners were very worried about white fans. You know, even if you could clear the hurdle for a team owner thinking a black man could actually succeed at that position, then owners also had to think about, well, would I even want one to succeed, because that might anger many of my white fans. So the guys you're talking about now have shown, you know all the things, the best traits that you would want in a franchise quarterback. And they lead their teams, and the biggest thing is that they do the things from a optic standpoint that you would want from your franchise quarterback. You know, they're leaders in the locker room. They lead on the field. They set the tone, and that's really what you want. And you know, I'd like to talk about the Deshaun Watson thing for a minute, situation rather, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
Because Deshaun Watson illustrates that situation, his individual situation, illustrates how far we have come. You know, there was a time in this country when if something happened with a black man, that people would say, white people would say, well, you know, that's indicative of how they are. You know, I'll never forget, you know, in researching the book, that you would I talked to old timers, and you know, they'd tell me, well, yeah, you know, they would say this person is a credit to his race, or you know, this person, you know, he shows, you know, how well black people can do this. So black people effectively were looked at as a monolith, and they were all lumped in together. The progress that we see is that we can measure the progress in terms of many different metrics, but one is that no one is out here saying that Deshaun Watson's situation in any way reflects on Patrick Mahomes, or in any way reflects on Lamar Jackson or Kyler Murray or or Russell Wilson or Dak Prescott. That the allegations about Deshaun Watson and what the NFL is working through right now with handing down disciplinary action for those allegations, it doesn't in any way disparage what these other players are doing. And I think that's very important, because when we look at the rise of the black quarterback, it mirrors the rise of black people in the United States writ large, in the sense that black people are no longer viewed by most, okay, in a manner in which if one black person does something, well, that's what they say all black people do. And I think that's very important, that these young men are looked at and judged as individuals. They're not judged as being, you know, a collective, so to speak, in that if one person does something that is untoward or is alleged to have occurred, that somehow puts a cloud over all of them. And you know, when we talk about progress, we want people to be judged as individuals. You know, we want, you know, I think back to Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech that everybody knows. You know, he talked about being judged by the content of your character, not by the color of your skin. And inherent in that means, I am judged as an individual, not because of the amount of melanin I have.
Mm.
And so I think it's very important that we look, things are not perfect in this country or in the NFL. Clearly racism still exists. But, you know, I'd be remiss if I did not acknowledge the progress that has been made. And this Deshaun Watson situation illustrates the progress that has been made.
Mm. That's a very, very good point, one which had not dawned on me. So I appreciate you saying that. And I appreciate all that we find in the pages of your really important book, again titled Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America, published by Anscape, which is a division of ESPN. Jason Reed, congratulations on a fine book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was great to talk with you.
Oh, the pleasure was mine, and thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Nan Calvert will be bringing with her Laura Buska from Root Pike Wynn. We'll be talking about salt, the importance of not injecting too much salt into the natural environment around us. We'll be talking about the damage that salt does. There is something called Salt Awareness Week and a program called Wisconsin Salt Wise that's actually about to go national. We'll be talking about that tomorrow. On Friday, we'll be previewing a really exciting event coming up at Carthage College. From Canvas to Cosmos, Soviet Art, Solaris, Space Exploration, and the Science of Serene Spaces. This is actually the second symposium that celebrates the school's acquisition of the Sam and Barry Schoen collection of Soviet art. And the symposium will include a number of presentations plus the screening of a Soviet-era film. And we'll be talking with actually four different Carthage faculty about this upcoming event. That will be on Friday.